I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented free by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. You're about to hear Robin Wright, veteran Middle East reporter and author of Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, in conversation with Warren Olney, host of To the Point and Which Way LA on KCRW 89.9 FM. Drawing on 35 years of reporting through wars, revolutions, and uprisings, one of America's most prescient journalists offers an insightful reckoning of the changes racking the Middle East and their impact on its and America's future. This program was originally produced on March 13, 2008. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
This is a special privilege for me and a pleasure for me because Robin's been on my program any number of times, but this is the first time we've actually been in the same room at the same time. So we were just delighted to meet one another. I was certainly delighted to meet her. And also to be able to read this book. It really is a remarkable book. Not very many people would have the courage to write a book, the subtitle of which is The Future of the Middle East. That's a big title. That's a big challenge. And as she says at the beginning of the book, the Middle East is an absolutely enormous place. How many countries? 22 countries?
22 Muslim countries and Israel.
And Israel. It's on two continents, many languages, many religions, much more diverse than you would believe reading the press, other than the reporting we get from Robin Wright. So since we now know, of course, we're going to have to be dealing with the Middle East for a very long time to come, this is really the right book at the right time. It's so rich, it's so full of detail, and so many interviews with so many interesting people, and other kinds of considerations that lead you to think about that region and our relationship to it in new and different ways. That it's a very important book, I think, and it's just a real pleasure for me and a privilege to be here and be able to talk to Robin about it. What were you thinking of? Why did you write this book?
Well, as was pointed out earlier, I first landed in the Middle East when the Fourth Middle East War broke out, and I've seen so many of the turning points. I've lived in the region for many years. I was in Beirut when the first suicide extremist bomber blew up the American embassy in 1983, and then over the next 18 months, another U.S. embassy in the Marine compound. I saw the birth of Islamic extremism with the Iranian Revolution. And in the aftermath of Iraq, the one thing that struck me over and over was how little we knew about Iraq when we went in. We were relying on a group of exiles headed by a man, Ahmed Chalabi, who had not been back to his home country since 1958. We had no sense of what the internal dynamics were. And so I thought one of the most important contributions I could make, and this is my fifth book on the Middle East, is to go back and take a look at what's going on in all 22 of the Muslim countries and Israel to try to get a sense of what's happening, where is it headed, who are the players, the actors, to make sure that we didn't make the same mistake again.
One of the things that's so fascinating about the book, as I indicated, is the number of people that Robin talked to and who they are. They're all very interesting, and I want to ask her about that and about some of them individually as we go along. But just to sort of set the stage, you say early on that, or you quote somebody saying, and I forget who it is, that the status quo in the Middle East is not sustainable. And you wrote recently in the Washington Post that great change is occurring. When you were first there in 1973, you thought Islamic extremism was going to be the major force in that area. But now you're more hopeful.
I'm a little bit more hopeful. And one of the interesting things to me was when I lived in the Middle East for so many years, I would go look for the clandestine cells, the extremists, the underground groups, as the barometer of opposition. And the Mujahideen, the holy warriors, the Hizbullahis. What's so interesting to me today is the more dynamic elements are reflected in what we've now nicknamed the pajama Hadeen, the people who, the young bloggers, the computer nerds, the kind of people I now look for no longer just the clandestine cells. They are carving out a whole new political space by challenging state-controlled media, state-controlled domination of everything. One of my favorite stories early in the book is about an Egyptian blogger who started his blog in 2004 and captured about a year and a half ago some video of police beating up a detainee, including sodomizing him with the end of a broomstick. And he had the cell phone video, he put it on his blog, and then it ended up on YouTube. And it created such a public outcry in Egypt that the government was forced to prosecute the two police. So this was a way of holding the government accountable, providing a new form, a new source of information, getting new input from people who were victims of human rights abuses in the country. And it changes the political dynamics in one simple way. He now is one of over 1,000 blogs in Egypt, a third world country, and he gets on his blog every day between 30 and 45,000 hits. And that's pretty impressive.
Tell us about the Egyptian woman who saw something on television that caused her to change her life.
Well, this is an interesting story because it shows you again how information technology has provided tools that were not available in the region before. And this wonderful woman I met named Gada Shabendor, she was a soccer mom. She was in the middle of a divorce. She had four athletic kids. She'd gone back to school to get a teaching certificate, very middle class, so that she'd have a source of income. She'd never voted, never been a member of a party, never held a little pink voting card that Egyptians have. And she saw on satellite television pictures of women being beaten up by a group of thugs with a row of policemen watching and doing nothing. And so she was so outraged by pictures you would not see on state-controlled television that she went down a week later and joined the protest. And she told me a delightful story of how the woman next to her recognized that she was a new face and said to her, "Did you bring 100 Egyptian pounds?" And Gada turned to her and said, "What do I need money for?" And the woman said, "Bail, of course." And she realized she'd gotten in, you know, into something new and different. But she didn't stop there. She formed a group called We're Watching You. And you is the Egyptian government. And they mobilized to try to figure out what kind of difference they could make. And presidential and parliamentary elections, separate contests, were approaching. And they decided that because international monitors were not elected, that they would form their own group. And she'd never been involved in politics before. So they went to some lawyers and said, "What is it that we should look for if we were advising people? Tell us, you know, what we need to, what kind of guidelines we can provide." They set up a website. They, by word of mouth, they put out two cell phone numbers that people could call if they saw any election fraud. They borrowed the office of a friend who had an advertising agency. And they showed up, and Gada was laughing and said, "We had no idea whether we'd get a single call, whether anybody had looked at our website, or what difference we could make." By the end of the day, they had over 1,000 cases of detailed election fraud, separate cases. They were so successful that the foreign embassies began turning to them as a barometer of change. Journalists went to them to find out statistics. For the parliamentary elections, they then decided to hire a cameraman. Now, this is a group of middle-class people who don't have a lot of money, don't have resources. And they took the camera to an area, to several areas where they knew opposition was strong. The government's favorite tactic in Egypt on voting days is to bus in their voters, their supporters. They vote early in the day, and then the police go out, and these kind of thugs, unofficial thugs, go out, and they harass voters. And so they captured on film, as sure enough, the voters were blocked from the polling station. They went, but the voters were so insistent on voting that they went and got a ladder to climb over the school fence to get in. And of course, as they began doing that, the police opened fire first with tear gas and then rubber bullets. But they got it all on video, and the government couldn't deny it. And the interesting thing about Gada is that she, and this is 2.5 years ago, that she is now invited to help monitor elections in other Arab countries. And she also persevered, and this is what's so interesting. It's not just during election periods that people are engaged now. She and her little We're Watching You group sued the government because it had signed an international corruption treaty and but had not followed through on the steps the government was supposed to take. So they sued the government. She's really quite inspiring, and she's, you know, to think a soccer mom out of nowhere would, again, redefine the political debate and begin to hold the government accountable.
And she turned up in Washington, D.C.
She did indeed. She also started a group of a program for kids called Kidmocracy. And again, with their own resources, a group of families that she knew decided they would sponsor a public contest for 13 and 14-year-olds to teach them about constitutions. She'd never read the Egyptian constitution. She had to learn from scratch herself, but she thought it was important in pressing for the rule of law that she understood what the laws were. And so the kids write essays, and they compare four constitutions. Two of them have to be the United States and Egypt, but they can pick any other two. And they do an essay about them. And the winners she brought to Washington, D.C.
That's reason for hope, no question about it. But on the other hand, you point out that President Mubarak of Egypt has been in office longer than any but, I believe, two other leaders of Egypt in 6,000 years.
And they were pharaohs.
Tells you something about the Middle East. They were pharaohs. So, but the question is, so what are the limits of this? And mm-hmm. you would think the ultimate objective would be to see the last of Mubarak, but he's grooming his son to take over.
Exactly. And he's ruled since 1981. And he's our friend. The book is about both dreams and shadows. But clearly, the next generation is going to witness a contest between what I call the three crats, the Democrats, the autocrats, and the theocrats. And the Democrats are the ones who are the most vulnerable, have the least resources, the poorest organization, and they're pitted against the autocrats, like Mubarak, who are well-entrenched, have no intention of ceding power, and will use all of their resources to stick around. And also pitted against the theocrats, who are increasingly strong because they believe they have a mission from God and they're tapping into the flock of the faithful. And it's going to be a very difficult battle. There's not a single among my dreamers, those who are the new generation of activists, there's not a single head of state. I think virtually in every country, leaders are out of sync with their populations today. And that's the downside. The hopeful side is people are beginning to do something about it.
You don't, in the book, treat either Saudi Arabia or Israel. Why not?
Good question. I thought long and hard about which countries to pick. Israel, at the end of the day, is the most robust democracy in the Middle East, and, I mean, it's not even a contest. And you could argue that Israel is the most robust democracy in the world, given the tiny size of the country and the extraordinary political spectrum. Everyone has a say. And much of what happens to Israel will be decided by what happens in the neighboring countries. I didn't pick Saudi Arabia because I didn't pick any other country in the Persian Gulf, even though I went to all of them, because there are no crises of change, no dynamic there that is pushing governments in a robust way. There are activists. Governments are being forced to respond. Kuwait, a couple of years ago, gave women the right to run for office and vote. Saudi Arabia had its first election, male only, and with a body of people who were appointed, which means that even the ones who are elected in local councils don't have enough votes to change anything if the king doesn't like it. But the seven places I picked are all ones that are on the front lines with Israel, or that have the kinds of movements that will determine what happens over the next quarter century in the region.
Well, let's talk about the Palestinians. You've spent a lot of time on the Palestinians, and all three of the Krats are certainly involved in what's going on there. And tell us about the Shakaki brothers.
Oh, very interesting. I actually framed the whole Palestinian chapter in terms of brothers, but the Shakakis are particularly interesting. They were in a refugee family, and one brother ended up at Columbia, where he did his PhD in political science, and he went home and he founded the first independent political research group in the region. He worked very closely with his Israeli colleagues during the early days of the peace process in the early 1990s to try to get a sense of Palestinian public opinion, how far they were willing to go, how much peace they were willing to embrace. He continues to this day to do a lot of research. He also has a joint appointment at Brandeis. His brother, older brother, went to school in Egypt, became a physician. The school he went to had a strong Islamist student body. He went back to Gaza and formed Islamic Jihad and was assassinated in 1995 in Malta in transit from Syria. And my point being that there is not only diversity in the region, but there's diversity even within a family. And I found this over and over and over in the region. It's quite interesting. One of my other favorite stories is about another set of brothers in Iran. One of them has been leading the protest against the supreme leader. And he started a newspaper, he writes editorials, calls for says that no one should be above the law. In Iran, the supreme leader has veto power over everything, any presidential decree, any judicial decision, any candidate running for office, any legislation. He is an infallible political pope. And so this young cleric I know started giving lectures on campuses and at seminaries, arguing against the idea of a supreme leader, and said that if there is one, they should be elected. He was often beaten up, often hospitalized with injuries. He tried to run for public office, and even though he was a cleric, he was disqualified for not being Islamic enough. What makes him so interesting is that his older brother is Iran's supreme leader.
So again, you get this. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? You know, did you know that there was that kind of relationship between the supreme leader and somebody who is in dissent and who obviously has been able to at least express himself? Has he ever gone to jail? Has he been persecuted?
Well, he's been beaten up. You know, not persecuted, but he's had a very rough run. And when I went to see him, what was so interesting was he'd taken his turban off, and it was just a long piece of cloth hanging on his coat rack, and his sleeves were rolled up. He looked kind of preppy, and with his kind of aviator sunglasses. And, you know, it's just not the image of the kind of clerics we're used to.
What about Islam and democracy? At one point, you talked to somebody who says that they are inextricably intertwined.
Well, I think this is one of the interesting trends. I mean, we have to all be very concerned given the emergence of Islam as a vibrant and sometimes threatening political idiom in the region. We in the West went through the Christian Reformation that gave birth to the Age of Enlightenment and then modern democracy, a period that's spanned 400 years. And as a woman, I'll say, it's not yet complete. But what we're trying to see happen in the Middle East is to have its Islamic Reformation, but we want it to happen at the same time they're going through a political overhaul. And so the debate in so many countries is, how do you blend these two in a way that discourages extremism and allows for genuine political openings in a way that we in the outside world would also like to see? And one of the, I'm not sure which of the many you're referring to, but one of my favorite characters is a man named Sarush, And he, another Iranian, a philosopher, an early revolutionary, turned against the revolution. And he now says, in popularized ideas about Islam, and what you need to know about Islam is that it literally means submission, as in to the will of God. And the theocrats believe there is only one path, and that must be followed strictly. What he says is that for you to be a true believer, even if you have accepted your faith because it was part of your family or your community or your country, but for you to be a true believer, you have to have come to your faith through your own free will. And therefore, freedom precedes religion. In the Islamic world, that's a revolutionary idea. And it begins that transition in getting them over the hurdle of diversity. It's, you know, there are so many interesting ways in which you see this diversity and that idea play out. People always ask me, well, that's fine, a philosopher, but, you know, how does it translate in real terms? Well, one of his followers or someone who's in his camp, let's say, is a film director, and he used to make revolutionary films. He also, like so many in Iran, became disillusioned with the revolution. And he made a movie about a woman, married woman, who had an affair with a younger man. And the end of the movie is told from three different perspectives. One is the married woman, one is her husband, and the third is the young lover. The movie was banned in Iran, not because of the subject of adultery, but because there were three different truths at the end.
As opposed to
one truth and one path.
Truth. Mm-hmm. Back to the issue of democracy, and I was just fascinated that that anybody would say that there was this relationship between Islam and democracy. The one place where in the Muslim world where there has been the overturning of an autocratic regime by a democratic opposition is in the Palestinian territories, and what you got was Hamas. Mm. What is Hamas? You talked to the leader of Hamas, who is in Damascus. I think very few people have talked with him.
Well, that's what I did for the book. As part of The Shadows, I went to see the bad boys of the region, too. I wanted to get a sense of the whole spectrum. So I saw the head of Hezbollah in Beirut, as well as the head of Hamas in Damascus. And it's clear that, you know, Hamas is not interested in a peace deal with Israel, like Fatah is. But one of the things that we don't understand in looking at what happened at that election, and I was there in 2006, was, and I interviewed a lot of people, and it was quite clear that Hamas was going to win. But the reason Hamas won, in the same way that Ahmadinejad won in Iran, was because people were rejecting the status quo. They were saying no to a half century of Yasser Arafat's Fatah. In Iran, they were saying no to a generation, 25 years, of rule by the clerics who'd become very corrupt, and so they elected a non-cleric. We tend to look at what happened in those countries in terms of our priorities, but people voted for them not because of any anti-American rhetoric or even peace positions, but because they don't like and want to send a strong message. And I think history will look back on both of these elections as turning points, even though they put very difficult parties into power.
When you spoke with Osama Hamdan, I think is the leader of Hamas in Damascus, what did he say? What were you able to ask him about, for example, Hamas's insistence that Israel has no right to exist?
Osama Hamdan is actually their man in Beirut. The head of Hamas is Khalid Mashal.
Okay.
And you know, the Hamas talks a lot about a hudna, which is a ceasefire. It's not peace with Israel, and they talk about it being open-ended until someone does something. That's not acceptable to us. It's not acceptable to the United Nations. It's not acceptable to the international community, as well as not acceptable to Israel. But it's interesting to me that Hamas has evolved. And again, it's not enough, but the fact is that it ran for an election. And that was also an important step in the evolution of Hezbollah. As I said, I was in Beirut when it launched the very first terrorist attacks. I lost a lot of friends at the two American embassies and the Marine compound. So it was a personal affront to me as well as one that angered me because it was an attack on my country. What was interesting to see Hezbollah and Hamas emerge from the underground, set up social services, and over a long period of time actually decide to participate in elections. It's worrisome because they haven't taken the steps of renouncing terrorism and recognizing Israel's right to exist. But it is an evolution. I just hope they take the other steps.
Will Hamas, do you think, allow an election to occur now that it's in power? Will it allow the possibility of being removed from power by a vote?
They claim they will. I'm not so sure. The whole peace process has become so much more complicated now because you have three parties, one of which doesn't recognize one of the parties' existence, and that's not acceptable. But Hamas is also now accountable, and I think one of the important steps we're all going to have to watch for is these Islamist groups that run for office suddenly plummet to earth because they have to deliver on health care and garbage collection. I'm struck by some of those who've run in places like Morocco, and where you have the most moderate Islamist group, and they run on the very earthly agenda of, you know, anti-corruption and health care and better education. In the case of Morocco, there's no piety on the agenda. No talk of Sharia or Islamic law, and a picture of the king hangs in the headquarters in Rabat. That's not true of Hamas and Hezbollah. But it is true that we have a spectrum today in the Islamic world where you have Al-Qaeda on one end and relying on nothing but extremism and violence. You have groups like the one I talked about in Morocco, which has run for parliament, is now the largest opposition group, recognizes Israel's right to exist, believes that the Jews in Morocco should have special guarantees. And then you have Hezbollah and Hamas in the middle, who have begun the transition, but still have a long way to go. When I wrote this book, I didn't want to give anyone the false sense of hope that, you know, change is around the corner, that it's tomorrow. I think that the worst terrorist attacks may still be in the future against us and against many of the countries in the region. I think that the transition is going to be tumultuous. In many ways, we'll wish for the simplicity of the days of the Arab-Israeli conflict, which we understood. There are going to be a lot of new parties that emerge, a lot of them with Islamic tenor. But I think the danger for us is if we stick to this policy indefinitely of holding to the stability of the autocrats, that the violence and the dangers to us down the road are all the more severe. It's not going to be a comfortable experience. But this is the last block of countries that has held out against the democratic tide. And unfortunately, so many of them have held out with our help. And that's cost us an enormous amount. And you add Iraq to that, and it becomes all the more difficult for what we really want to see happen in the region, and that is a better government.
How is it viewed in the Middle East that the United States encouraged the election in the Palestinian territories and then essentially refused to recognize the outcome?
Well, I mean, so many in the region believe we're hypocrites. They believe that ultimately we're in the region for oil or to establish military bases, you know, for our own interests. They never believed the weapons of mass destruction issue, even if, you know, the White House did. They didn't buy the Al-Qaeda argument. They knew that Al-Qaeda was not active in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Saddam was the most secular leader in the region, and the idea of having religious extremists as allies, even if the enemy of my enemy is my friend, that even that doesn't hold in bringing them, Al-Qaeda and Saddam, together. And so when they look around, they wonder what it is we're after. And the fact that we pushed harder than the Israelis or the Palestinians, they didn't want an election. They thought the situation wasn't the right moment. We pushed for it, and then we turned around and said no. Now, there are ways. I mean, it's clear that we should not engage with Hamas. but there are other ways that we could have been helpful in with the Palestinians in ensuring that there was that moderation emerged.
Why should we not engage with Hamas in the sense of having a conversation with them, as you did with Hamas leaders? Obviously, you're not a diplomat; you don't represent the United States, but
mercifully.
But the argument's being made that it's time to sit down with people and at least have a conversation and see if there's some way of reaching an accommodation of some kind, whether it's a hudna or whatever else. Why should we not do that?
That's a good question. U.S. policy in dealing with the PLO was very effective. We held out for a long time until Yasser Arafat finally agreed to recognize Israel's right to exist and renounce terrorism, even though some of his allies, some of his own people, didn't always honor that renunciation of terrorism. And I think it's important that for us to deal with Hamas, that we hold them to the same standard. We can't engage them in the peace process until they do. We can't give them American aid until they do. But we can hold out the prospect of, if you take these important steps, you can be part of the process.
Talk a little bit about Lebanon and what's going on there. It's such an interesting place, and you have very interesting things to say about it. And your title of one of your chapters about Lebanon is Dreamers, and the other one is Shadows. And, of course, Dreams and Shadows is the title of the book.
Well, one of the things that was so interesting to me, having lived in Lebanon during the Civil War, was going back and seeing a group of people turning out, a group of people that amounted to 1/4 of the entire population, turn out peacefully to demand the Syrians leave, end a 29-year occupation. One of the people I write about is a woman who was, she's a woman in a man's world, she's a Christian in a Muslim, you know, dominated region, and yet she helped mobilize over 1 million people. And not only just to come down and demonstrate, and they did it with text messages, and she did it to all her friends and said, pass it on. I mean, this is another one of the new tools. I remember Lebanon when we didn't have phones. You know, you did street reporting because, you know, there was no alternative. And she organized porta potties and meals and so forth so that a group of the demonstrators, protesters, could stay until the Lebanese government resigned and the Syrians pledged that they would leave. This is something that the international community has not been able to do in resolution after resolution. And the Lebanese ended up doing for themselves. Now, clearly Lebanon has extraordinary problems today. They haven't been able to re-elect a president since November. Not re-elect, just elect a president since November. Because of the divide between pro- and anti-Syrian parties. But the interesting thing is, even though there's sporadic tension, Lebanon has not disintegrated again into civil war. People do not want it. And this is where you begin to see one of the many sea changes in the region that I found so interesting, that 7 years after 9/11, people have begun rejecting al-Qaeda and extremism and violence. They've had enough in so many places. They see that these groups destruct, but they don't provide viable alternatives. And the people of the region are aware of what's happened in so many other parts of the world over the last 30 years, with the end of military dictatorships in Latin America, the end of apartheid and minority rule in Africa, the demise of communism in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. They understand the forces of globalization, and they don't want to be left behind. They understand that al-Qaeda gives them no constructive alternative that will provide better health care, education, housing, you know, a better future for their kids. And I think we see it in the one success we've had in Iraq, and we don't even deserve credit for it, and that is when the young tribal elders in Anbar province, the most violent part of Iraq, particularly one young sheikh named Sheikh Sattar, who was famous for his Gucci sunglasses and his pearl-handled revolver. And his father and his two brothers were murdered, assassinated by al-Qaeda, and he said, enough. And he mobilized the tribal elders, and to take a stand, to form the first Awakening Council in Iraq. And it wasn't just this core of people. They then mobilized 90,000 Iraqis in Anbar province to join a police and army unit to fight al-Qaeda. They've forced al-Qaeda back from so much of Anbar. The tragedy, of course, is that Sheikh Sattar last September was assassinated in another roadside bomb. And his brother took over the Awakening Council, but it's the last brother in that family. But again, there are the signs of people taking important action in Lebanon and Iraq and elsewhere.
There's a lot of history in your book, and it occurs to me to ask you to just sort of recount briefly the history of Iraq since the end of the Ottoman Empire. It's really an artificial country.
Well, so many of the countries of the region are artificial, except for Egypt. And one of the big questions, because of the diversity of in Iraq, formed by the Europeans, the French and the British, bringing together three different kind of city-states around Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra, that it's always striking to me to what degree any of these countries have a national identity. And I've been struck in many cases by the fact that the Kurds, which is the big question in the north, if Iraq falls apart, then you have a precedent, a very dangerous precedent. Like Yugoslavia, will others follow suit because they're an unnatural union? And I'm struck by the fact that the Kurds in northern Iraq were isolated for a dozen years. They were isolated because the U.S. sanctioned Iraq, but also because Iraq sanctioned the Kurds because that's where the opposition was, and they were stranded. Saddam Hussein hoped to isolate them and starve them out, starve them into submission. And instead, the Kurds thrived. But they also learned that a little landlocked area was dependent on neighbors like Iran and Turkey, and they didn't want to be beholden to either, and that being outside of Iraq wasn't a great alternative for them. And the leaders, anyway, would... And I think indefinitely, this is not, you know, for 10 years or 20 years, would like to see that Kurdish community stay inside Iraq to see if they can make a go of it.
You had a very interesting conversation with a Kurdish leader at a very interesting moment. It was as the invasion was being planned. We didn't know for sure that it was being planned, but because we were still going before the UN and whatnot, but there were already a lot of Americans running around in the country. You got yourself in there illegally by crossing the border. Tell us about the conversation you had then, and put it in that context, because I think it's very interesting in the sense of what happened since.
Well, I walked across the border from Iran into Iraq, which was a really spooky thing to do because I didn't have a visa. I was there illegally.
It was 2003.
This is 2000. The end of 2002.
2002.
Because we knew that we were headed toward an invasion. And I actually, and it was very interesting because even though we kept saying that no, we had no plans and we were still going to go the UN route, the Kurdish North was crawling with Americans, you know, CIA military planners looking at airfields, what do we need to do? Because they still thought they were going to have a northern front. And I walked across this no man's land, the border, and there was nobody on the other side. I had to walk quite a ways until I was met by some of the Kurdish militia men. And even though it was wild, because it was November, early November, and I went to a very good friend of mine was the prime minister of Kurdistan then, and I went to his house for dinner that night, and we sat watching on his satellite television the election results in the United States, flipping between CNN and MSNBC. And this was a time when Saddam Hussein, you know, there was no CNN in downtown Baghdad, but, you know, there were these links with the outside world that the Kurds had. And I talked to them about, you know, the future of Iraq, and they were afraid that the United States was going to once again do what it had done in the past, and that was get involved, accomplish what it wanted, and then leave. And how prescient this prime minister was. He's today the deputy prime minister of all Iraq and wants to become the first Kurdish prime minister. Fat chance, I keep telling him. But and when I talk to him now, he says the same thing. He's afraid that we've gone in and we'll leave at a time that Iraq is still not stable. It's interesting hearing him saying the same things on both sides of the war.
Weren't you scared as hell to cross that border?
Yes. In fact, I have to tell you, I won an award for courage a long time ago, and for covering some African wars. And my mother went to New York to accept it, and she got up on stage and said, "You know, I'm honored my daughter won this award, but I'm also flabbergasted because she was so afraid of things as a child that I had to pay the neighbor boy to walk her to school until she was in the sixth grade." I still don't like riding elevators, you know. I'm not courageous, but I think this extraordinary opportunity to witness history, to talk to so many of the players in the world, and I've now covered over 140 countries, and you know I've flown with the last Pope a good deal. I covered wars in Africa. I've seen kind of all the great moments and. Of history in my lifetime, and I'm trained as an historian. So to me, I kind of say to myself, what the hell am I doing here? And then I keep going. And a lot of them I look back on as out-of-body experiences.
Do you have some sense of invulnerability?
No. No, 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 no. Oh, no. I mean, I've got a lot of horror stories, too. And walking across the Iranian border into Iraq, into Saddam Hussein's Iraq, knowing that if I got captured, you know.
Did you know those Kurdish militiamen were going to show up on the other side?
I hope they did.
So plans had been made. You didn't just
Well, I told them about when I was coming. But what you do is you fly to Tehran, you get various police permissions to cross the border. You fly down to a place called Kermanshah. Then you drive 3 hours to the border. And at the border, there's a little guy with a ledger. And it's a smuggling post. And that's where the smuggling trucks come and go. And you sign the ledger. And you show him your American passport. And he says, Alan Mosalan, you know, welcome. And I walk across the border, and there's nothing on the other side, nothing. So I just, with my little hand carry rolling behind me, just kept walking, you know, hoping that somewhere, which you have to understand, this was the time that Ansar al-Islam, which was the most militant group, was headquartered very close by, and I kept thinking, just keep walking, following, you know, go due west, because if I went just a little bit southwest, I'd walk right into their territory. So,
you talk a lot about young people, and in two different ways. We think of, many of us do at least. You see protests on the street, and you see young people who seem to be under the control of mullahs and very receptive to the idea of violent jihad or whatever it is that they have in mind. And yet you also see a lot of hope in the young people, the nerds who use the cell phones and the other kinds of technology. Talk a little bit more about the coming generation and to the extent that you can generalize about it
well,
in such a large area.
Well, it's an extraordinary issue for the future of the region because they're beginning their baby boom. And 70% of the population is under 30, in some countries under 25. And these are people who know what's happened in the rest of the world. They're connected. They have some of the tools anyway. And they're going to define the political debate in the country and eventually define the political systems. And even in a place like Iran, I can tell you the contrast. This is the most restrictive society. When I first went to Iran during the revolution, I remember once when I flew in, I had very pale pink nail polish. Men wouldn't even notice the difference between what I have now and the pale pink. And the stewardess said to me, no nail polish. And I had no nail polish remover, so I went to Iran with 10 Band-Aids on my fingers. And in those days, women had to wear black stockings, thick black stockings, and be really covered. Today in Iran, the girls wear bright red nail polish on their fingernails and on their toenails because so many of them don't wear black stockings. Now, sure, there are lots of young people, the conservative traditional families, who still wear their chadors. But I like to go back, particularly in November, to see the commemoration of the takeover of the American Embassy to get a sense of what the public mood is. They call it Pupils Day, and they make all the kids in the schools come down to the old U.S. Embassy. And I'm often struck by some of the Islamic dress. One of them, one of the girls last time, had on a black skirt and a big black, baggy black sweatshirt that said across the front of it, Planet Hollywood, Las Vegas. And even though we're cut off from Iran, it's quite striking to me how well Iranians know us. And the kids like to go to Western movies. And there was a twin bill a couple of years ago at one of the movie theaters, and they were showing Fahrenheit 9/11 and Kill Bill. So, you know, it's not the strict society. And the girls particularly, how they do it, I don't know. It's the physics of it amaze me. They wear scarves, but now they're brightly colored, and they wear them on the crown of their heads. I don't know. It's like they have glue or something. I don't know how they hold them there, and yet they never move. And they'll have big blonde, that luscious black hair, and they'll have big blonde streaks. I mean, you know, it's lots of makeup. It's a different place. The young now are of such numbers, even in places like Iran, that, you know, Khomeini banned Western music. He called it West toxication. They couldn't even play Beethoven. When Rafsanjani ran for election 2 years ago, he'd been president before, had, was trying to make a comeback. He hired young girls who were roller skating around the city with the little boom boxes. He had, you know, the closest thing to rock and roll playing in tents in the parks. You know, it's just it's a different place. And that's because people have to be aware of what the young want in these countries, because that's where the votes are.
There are those who say that rock and roll brought down the Berlin Wall. Is it going to make a big difference in the Middle East then?
To a certain degree, it's a different kind of, it's a much more nasal. For anybody who knows Kaltum, you know, it's not my kind of music, but.
Is it easier for you to travel now in other countries besides Iran as a woman doing the kind of work that you do than it was in 1973? Are some of the other countries that you write about, Syria, Morocco, places that one would think are somewhat less liberated than you just described Iran? Is it hard for you to get around? Do you have to dress in a certain way? Do you have to behave differently?
When I go to Iran, I have to wear a scarf, but I would wear kind of what I'm wearing now.
Morocco, same thing?
Oh, Morocco is very very secular. Syria is very secular. That's not an issue. What I worry about in Syria is the secret police. Syria is the most brittle society in the region in many ways. I think the most difficult to crack. One of my favorite stories, if I can tell it, is about...
Please do.
A man named Riyad Turk. He's the Nelson Mandela of Syria. One of the reasons I wanted to go to the region and find people was because someone said to me, there are no Lech Walesas in the Middle East. So I set out to find out who were the Lech Walesas, who were the Nelson Mandelas. And I found a Nelson Mandela in Syria. He'd been imprisoned time after time after time. And when he was 50, he was picked up once again by the Syrians and for protesting totalitarian rule. And he was held in a room the size of an elevator shaft with no furniture, no bed, no toilet, no pen, no paper, no window, no access to the outside world, no charges against him, no trial, not knowing how long he'd be held. He didn't know what happened to his family. His wife was picked up at the same time he was. And he kept his sanity by taking the uncooked kernels of rice from his soup at night and during the day using them to draw geometric designs on the floor of his cell. He did that for 18 years. And what happened when he came out at the age of 68? He started protesting the government again. And what happened? He went back to jail. And I saw him after he got out the fourth time. a few weeks afterwards, now in his mid-70s. You know, he'd missed the upbringing of his children. And rather than retreat into mellow old age in the comfort of his family, he was out there still speaking out. And he's not the only one. There are lots of those kinds of people. You know, in Syria, as we so often do with other countries as well, we look at Syria's meddling in Lebanon, Syria's facilitating of foreign fighters into Iraq, Syria playing spoiler on Arab-Israeli peace. But we really don't look at what's happening inside Syria. And so that's what I try to do as a microcosm with all of these countries, to get a sense of who's doing what and what are the potential for change. And he was very interesting. I said to him, you know, do you think that someday in your lifetime you'll see something different? And he's now in his late 70s, mid to late 70s, and he said, probably not. But what if I didn't do what I'm doing now? Could I live with myself for living with this kind of injustice? And that's something that I couldn't do. But there are lots of people like him.
It's fascinating to hear you talk about this, and it's also fascinating to read about it in the book. Why don't we open this to you and the audience? I think Justin is back there with the microphone. Justin, don't hand anyone the microphone. You'll never get it back. But why don't you go to this gentleman right here who has his hand up right in front of you. Right over here. careful, Justin.
Lately, with Barack's campaign, the success of her building on Howard Dean and becoming much more sophisticated about using the internet and blogging, your comment about what I guess I would call Nerdistan in your travels leads me to think that the digital divide, which we used to relate to the haves and have-nots, but now it's really kind of a generational thing, that we're witnessing a phenomenon of young people realizing the sort of inherent power of kind of the network effect, mm-hmm. and catalyzing on that basis. Is this an illusion of mine, or do you pick up on this trend?
I think that's a very legitimate trend. I think there is a have and have-not element to it, in that those without education, without the income to buy a computer. This is where I think we can actually make a huge difference. The way we use our aid, instead of giving it to Egypt to be a good chunk of it used for security, which often helps entrench Hosni Mubarak's rule, whether we give it to non-government organizations that are buying computers, setting up computer centers, providing, you know, access to library books that have something in them that's not anti-Western, or that there are a lot of ways we can help the process even while we stand back, and we can provide access to those kinds of tools, so that the young are all hungry for it. They're all aware of it. They'd all love to have access to it. They show up at internet cafes. It's astounding the number of kids who show up to rent computers, even if they have very little. They'll use, you know, a week's income to go in to spend an hour or two on the internet. So it's a very wise observation he made.
How much money would it take to encourage that kind of thing, as opposed to the kind of defense spending that we do?
You know, you pointed out...
Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, exactly. But $12 billion a month in Iraq, you know. Ghada Shabendur, this wonderful Egyptian woman who organized the Kidmocracy program, when I closed the book, in fact, with the anecdote, when she was bringing her first group of winners to Washington, and they'd, you know, mobilized in a third world country, you know, the airfare to bring the kids and to keep them in Washington for a week and so forth. And she said, oh, what we could do with just one day of money that you spent on the Iraq War.
Yes, down here, this gentleman.
Given your expertise and your familiarity with the area, why do you think we went into Iraq?
Turn the camera off. You know, unfortunately...
This isn't Egypt. You can speak out. It's all right.
It's a good question. I think, unfortunately, that the White House really did believe that there were weapons of mass destruction. I mean, a lot of us who know Iraq, I saw Saddam Hussein's usage of chemical weapons against Iran. I know that he had the capability. I saw the victims of chemical weapons in Halabja, in the Kurds, in the north of his own country. Clearly, he had the capability. You know, I think there were the neoconservatives who had illusions about you could go in, we could do it cheaply, then Iraqi oil would pay for it, and that people the next day would return to work and begin, you know, creating a democratic country out of a dictatorship. I mean, it was just such a pipe dream. It's unbelievable. And that's, again, why one of the reasons I wrote this book, because we don't have a sense of what's going on in any of these places. I think that history will look on our intervention in Iraq as the gravest mistake the United States ever made in foreign policy. And I think that it's going to cost us for a long time in the region and the rest of the world in terms of our credibility, because a lot of other people ask that question. Ask
go
a
to
woman.
Another part of the...
Ask a woman.
Pardon me?
Yes,
ask
I was going to the woman up in the back there. Whoops.
I'm all for empowering women.
You know, one of the things that has come out with Iraq and everything is our lack of ability to communicate with the people, because we don't have anybody who speaks Arabic. We don't have anybody who speaks Farsi.
Still, to this day.
To this day. Do you speak those languages?
You know, when I lived in Beirut, I got to the point that I understood a great deal. I used a lot of French. You know, one of the problems, if I had to say to a young person today, preparing for any profession, the two things you should learn are two languages, one of them Latin-based and one of them not, whether it's Chinese, Japanese, Russian, Arabic, defined, that we are more poorly prepared for globalization than any other developed country. And it's in part because of our lack of knowledge of other cultures, which begins with language training. If I had my life to do over, that's the one thing I'd do differently. I speak a lot of, you know, years I lived in Africa, I got to the point that I understood some Swahili, some Zulu, even some Xhosa. When I lived in Italy, I listened to the Italian news in the evening and understood it, but I never learned how to conjugate a verb. And so, you know, didn't want to cover a press conference that way. The next generation, the younger generation, there are more and more foreign correspondents that speak the language, but there still need to be more. It's pitiful what the United States has not done to prepare ourselves, whether it's, you know, Farsi, Urdu, I mean, languages throughout the Islamic world. We can't communicate. And not only that, but we have a problem with something I call the embassy Rolodex, there are certain people we have communications with, and they have to be able to speak English. They, you know, preferably have gone to a Western school. They don't really represent the populations in their countries anymore, but they're acceptable to us because they've had the Western experience. And that's not where the future lies in any of those countries.
Justin, there's a woman right here in the front row who has had her hand up several times.
You spoke with Larry Mantle briefly this morning about feminism, and you've talked about some of the women that you met in the book. Can you talk about, is there a feminist movement in these countries in terms of jobs, politics, religion, education, and also what is the situation for other religions in these countries?
Well, that's a very good question. One of my favorite stories is about a woman who in my lifetime was born in a harem. And not the harem that we associate with, you know, one man and many wives. It's a family harem where the extended family all lives together, and the patriarch and the men kind of dominate the first floor. They run their lives out of that. And the women are on the second and third floors, the grandmother, the aunties, the cousins, and the daughters. And you may have heard me talk about Fatima Mernissi, whose father did not let the women listen to the radio. He kept it locked behind a cabinet But Fatima, as a little girl, was so curious about this that she watched where her dad hid the key. And she would unlock the cabinet when her father left, and she would go listen to news of the outside world. And she became so intrigued that she convinced her mother, all the other women were illiterate, to talk to her father about getting an education and letting her go to public school. And the mother convinced the father to have a family council. And after much acrimonious debate, they decided to let her go to school. And this happened again and again through junior high and high school and so forth. She ended up at the Sorbonne, and she got her PhD at Brandeis. And she is today the Arab world's leading feminist. And she's written a great body of work about challenging the idea of the veil, and the veil being a symbol, but all the traditions that have been added over the centuries limiting the role of women, which she argues was not the original intention when the religion was founded. It differs from country to country how active the women are, but what's interesting to me is even in a place like Saudi Arabia, the issues are things, simple things like letting women drive, but women do sneak out, and they go in back roads, and they drive, and it's an issue that I think the king's going to have to rule on in the near term. Kuwait, forced to give women the vote and to allow women to run as candidates in the last election a couple of years ago. So there is movement. There is a beginning. Another woman in Morocco mobilized 1 million signatures, 40% of them male, behind a petition demanding the change in family law, which is the main laws that have limited women's rights because they deal with her rights in marriage, her rights to work, her rights to travel and be an entity without, you know, getting her husband's or her father's written permission. And it forced the king to change family law. So now that marriage is established by a government clerk, not a religious authority, men and women go in with equal rights, equal access, and equal rights to divorce. The age of marriage has been bumped up to 18. So that there is a beginning, clearly not enough, but the empowerment of women is, you know, half the battle.
Let's go over here. There's a gentleman over here on the corner.
What do you think would be the best way of getting out of Iraq, if you think we should? And should we also leave the Middle East?
It's such a hard question because for someone like me who really had very grave concerns about going in the first place, my fear is, as I said earlier, that we're going to steamroller out. And there's a lot of talk already in Washington about those of us who know the region about Gulf War II, that we leave such instability behind and become so messy that we have to go back in again. Perish the thought. But we had to do that in Afghanistan. How to get out? I think it's important that we begin the process by saying we're going to take out X number thousand of troops to show that our good intent. I think we have to negotiate an agreement with the Iraqis that doesn't include a lot of the demands that will make the region fear we want permanent bases. That's going to mean demanding less than we have elsewhere. One of the reasons Ayatollah Khomeini became a symbol of the opposition in Iran was because American troops were given total immunity, as we demand in state, they're called status of forces agreements, from any prosecution, so that if an American killed an Iranian, he wouldn't be tried in Iran. And that's what we want to demand, the same thing in Iraq, and people don't like that idea. So we're going to have to compromise probably in getting less. We may get the Iraqi government to agree, but I think they're going to be there will be suspicions in the region. But I think we also have to be very thoughtful about how we get out. As I said, I didn't want troops to be there originally. My fear is that there'll be some arbitrary date that we're going to pull out, and the Iraqis won't be ready. And that's going to lead to deeper sectarian violence. We need to make sure that a lot of the important steps, the barometers, the benchmarks, are achieved. Things like provincial elections, which is critical in devolving power so that the provinces feel they have a say in their future. And that deals with not just the provinces, but, you know, the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Kurds, and that they each feel they're having their fair share of the budget, their fair say in what happens in their regions in terms of development, and that nobody's excluded. A lot of these important political steps need to be taken. I would love to be able to say, let's get them all out. Nothing would please me more, because I didn't want them there in the first place. And I think Iraq, the lesson of Iraq is we will never be able to do this again, at least not in my lifetime, in a long time to come. I think it's taken Iran off the table. I think the administration would be very foolish to consider doing anything militarily, because if you thought Iraq was hard, beware Iran. I wish I had an easy answer for you, but I don't think there is one.
Why don't we go over here on this side of the room?
Yeah, I have two questions that are unrelated, but they're both short.
Don't count on me remembering them, so do one at a time.
They're both short. I'll do them both together. One is, how would it change the dynamic in Palestine if Marwan Barghouti, if I pronounced that correctly, was released? And the second one is, you earlier, very early in the conversation, talked about a coming Islamic Reformation. I don't understand how such a thing could take place. You don't have there's tremendous diversity in Islam now. There's nothing to reform.
Interesting point. Marwan Barghouti is a man who represents the second generation of Fatah. He's been imprisoned on murder charges in Israel for several years. His release is a point of perpetual debate and speculation. He's probably the most popular leader in Fatah, and he represents a real break from Arafat. He disapproved of Arafat in many ways. It would make a difference probably, but it would have to be under the right circumstances that he was released, something that was acceptable to Israel. I think if there's another election, the Israelis may feel that some of the people around Barghouti need to be included in the process. Many of the people who were elected were actually in prison already. And the second question, I'm sorry, I told you I'd forget. Oh, the Reformation. Yeah, there is a spectrum within the Islamic world, both in terms of the number of sects within SECTS in Islam. And there's a great diversity. I mean, I didn't answer your question about religious diversity in the region, but it is figuring out ways for different communities in their own ways to bridge, you know, to blend the ideas of Islam and democracy. You know, the Islamic Reformation is not going to be like the Christian Reformation, in part because they don't have the time, the luxury of time. They're trying to do too much, an awful lot at the same time. But I do think it's going to take a lot of new ideas to ensure that the kind of hateful ideologies of Al-Qaeda are rejected. That's where you have people saying there's one path. Whether the autocratic theocrats in Shiite Iran also saying there's one path. The hopeful thing to me is that so many people now embrace the idea of multiple paths in politics, in religion. You know, I make a point of going whenever I can to the Jewish communities. And one of the most interesting is in Iran. It's the second, after Israel, it's the largest Jewish community in the Middle East. And the majority have left, but there are still 30,000. And they still dominate the carpet business. I've gone to synagogue and temple, and I've gone to kosher butchers. And the Jewish hospital in Tehran is the most popular for the Ayatollahs. There's a Jewish school. There is an awareness of the minority issue in so many of these countries. And it's not just Jewish minorities, it's Christian minorities. 10% of Egypt is Coptic Christian. A quarter of the Palestinians are various Christians. The interesting thing in Ramallah, which is the capital of the West Bank, is that the tradition has always been that there was a Christian mayor, even though this, the city, which was founded by Christian clans that came in from Yemen centuries ago, is now predominantly Muslim, but they still honor that tradition. And I went in on election day and interviewed the Christian mayor, a woman, who got more votes from the Islamists than she did even from Fatah. There is a consciousness about this issue. It's still a sensitive one in every country. But getting to your point of the Islamic Reformation, again, there are the beginnings of ideas.
Isn't it sort of hard to talk about Reformation when there's so many different kinds of Islam? And
well,
in the case of the Christian Reformation,
you had one church.
They had one target, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say it's going to take different forms. It's not going to be, you know, there's not going to be one Martin Luther. There are going to be lots of them.
Okay. Let's have this woman down here on the in the front row.
Well, as a journalist, I'm interested in your, I mean, as you being a journalist, I'm not a journalist, I'm interested in your view of Al Jazeera, and both in terms of how it reports in the Middle East, and also in terms of its absence in the American media. I know that there's a TV version now of Al Jazeera in English, but that it's not carried by our American cable operators. So I guess that's two questions, if I might ask.
It's an interesting question. I've been to Al Jazeera headquarters several times. If I can recommend a movie called Control Room, which is actually quite interesting. You know, Al Jazeera has also gone through its own transition. It was, you know, took a heavy line in the early days. One of the things I find so interesting is that they have reached out to so many American officials and to be interviewed. And occasionally the United States is, this administration is wise enough to allow the odd official to go on Al Jazeera. I say, hey, go on it every time. It eats up space that the bad guys don't get, you know. But I've been there, you know, at their headquarters and been struck by whether it was Princess Di's death or an election in the United States. They don't do just propaganda. And one of the most important things to happen was that Al Jazeera, in the case of Lebanon, when you had a million people turned out on the streets of Beirut, broadcast that nonstop in the same way CNN did with Elliot Spitzer. You know, it was, you know,
Britney Spears.
Yeah, or Britney Spears, right? That this was a way of getting the message of change across throughout the region. So it plays an important role. We don't always like what it says. A lot of people in the Middle East don't like what CNN or the BBC say. You know, it's too bad that we don't have greater diversity in our knowledge of what others have to say. As I said earlier, I'm so struck by how much others know about us from the region, and we know so little about them. And that's, I often say that one of the answers to extremism and terrorism is education, not just getting the kids in the Middle East out of the madrasas and giving them proper education. It's teaching us about that part of the world. How many Americans know that Allah is not a different God, that it's just the Arabic word for God? And I often astound audiences when I lecture. I tell them about Christmas cards I get from Muslims who quote from the Quran about the birth of Jesus and the Virgin Mary. And the Virgin Mary is a role model for a lot of Muslim women. There, lots of women academics have done their theses on the Virgin Mary. I happen to be a devout agnostic, you know, you can take them all, but it's quite interesting to me how, you know, Americans don't realize it's part of one religious tradition, and that's just one of a zillion things we don't know.
I suggest you organize a network of nerds to try to get the cable systems to put Al Jazeera in English on, and you might be able to, that's the only thing they respond to is audience.
I think you can get it on the internet. I mean, if you
you can get them on the internet, and we've had the Washington Bureau of Al Jazeera on our programs. They're very smart, very articulate, very knowledgeable, really interesting people, and appear to be very good reporters as well. This woman over here has had her hand up several times, and so let's make that the last question.
You mentioned once traveling with the Pope.
I think you have to need to point it at your. Oops. Switched off.
You mentioned once traveling with the Pope.
Is it on?
Now you got it.
Oh, you mentioned once traveling with the Pope, and I understand that he was behind the Solidarity movement in Poland. Did he have any sympathies with any of these countries that you did your work in?
He wasn't behind the Solidarity movement. He supported it.
Well, he
allowed
supported
the church. In the same way, in the Philippines, he allowed Cardinal Sin to speak out against Ferdinand Marcos. I also was in Brazil with him when he stood in front of 100,000 trade union workers and shouted, Solidarnosc, Solidarnosc, urging those trade unions to follow the way of those their brothers in Poland and take on or urge change in a military dictatorship. He was a very interesting political phenomena, and was an extraordinary moment, extraordinary person to travel with. And I was often the only woman on the plane, and he'd come back to me. I have a great picture of him putting his arm around me, and he's making a point, but it looked like he's saying, behave yourself for a change. And we had great debates on social policy and family planning and so forth. You know, I think he was the first pope to go to a mosque. He went to the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus, took off his shoes, and went in. That was a very important step, in the same way he reached out to Jewish rabbis of Rome. It sent an important signal of multiculturalism and so forth. He, I went to Karachi with him in Pakistan. I also went to Japan, where I said to one of the Japanese people in the bureau where I worked at the time, I said, do you understand who this man is? And he said, oh, yes, he's one of your Jesus freaks. But I do think that he was actually interested in reaching out to the Islamic world and had begun an important healing process.
I don't know if she behaves herself or not, but she writes well and she speaks well, and she's sure been around. She's going to be signing her books out in the lobby.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.